when you read the analysis of it, it's very clear that there's warrant in doing it at this time, because it shines a light on the fact that entrepreneurs will be important with the economic recovery.
Hello, everyone. I'm Gary Fox, and this is the Entrepreneur Experiment Podcast. Welcome. This week, we've got a very special episode. We've got how to get rich list. That was the biggest pun I could come up with on that. That's not even a pun. We're talking about how to get rich, and specifically how to get on the rich list. Every year, I absolutely love the Sunday Times rich list, because I think it's a snapshot of where we are as an economy and in the world. And you know what? It's just good escapism. So we look at the 1,000 richest people in the UK. The Irish one is on hold for the minute due to Corona and COVID and all that jazz. So we run through the UK rich list. Who's top? Why they top? How do they make their money? How do you get on the rich list? How is it compiled? And I am joined by Conor McMahon from the Sunday Times. Conor is a business journalist, a superb business journalist with the Sunday Times. I enjoy reading him every single Sunday. So it is brilliant to have an expert who can actually break it down for us, and we kind of get into the details of, you know, have these people made their money? Do they want to be on the rich list? Do they not? How did they hide it? How did they find it? You know, how did they find out information about all these people? So it's a really good chat. Look, I nerded out. I love this stuff. So it was more of a guilty pleasure for myself. So I hope you enjoyed as well. And at the end, stick around, because I got Conor to kind of run through his masterclass for entrepreneurs and startups as to how they can get coverage for their own startups and for themselves, and just kind of do's and don'ts and just really practical advice about, you know, how to get press and media for your company, you know, why you need it, why you shouldn't get it, why, you know, you should build relationships with journalists. So it's a really great piece at the end. So stick around, and I will chat to you next Thursday as usual for the podcast. So for now, here is the Rich List Special with Conor McMahon from the Sunday Times. Conor, welcome to the pod.
Thank you very much.
You're joining me all the way from Kildare.
Yes, from the exotic County Kildare.
I even put a shirt on today for you, Conor. I knew we were doing the Rich List, so I said I'd put on a shirt for the first time in about 3 months.
Yes, you dress for the job you want, not the job you have. I think that's the old
very true thing. Very true. You're going to teach me how to get on the Rich List today.
If only.
How's life been for you?
Yeah, it's been fine. I've kind of been dealing with technological challenges more than anything else, adjusting to home working. I think like everybody else, sort of just finding a whole new rhythm to life. Well, a big one for me is obviously the lack of a commute, which has been a bit of a lifesaver. But yeah, it's very, very strange putting together a newspaper at a distance.
Yeah, I suppose you should probably explain who you are first. Actually, I kind of jumped in there, didn't even give you an intro. Do you want to give us a quick intro as who you are?
Yeah, I'd imagine very few people know who I am. So I'm Conor McMahon. I'm a business reporter with the Sunday Times. Been there, actually not been there terribly long, since November last year.
And before that, where were you?
Before that, I was with Fora.ie, which sadly is now defunct. It was a business website that was part of the Journal Media Group. I'd been there for about 3 years, had worked as a reporter, also then deputy editor, left to do other things. And sadly, in the meantime, they had to shut up shop thanks to COVID-19. They're still continuing. They have like a daily newsletter through the Journal. So there's a legacy there that they've continued, but for a is no more.
Yeah, it's kind of symptomatic of everything at the minute. There's not a kind of day goes by that some sort of business, or especially media outlet, seems to be kind of, you know, there's, you know, talks to different media outlets during the week. It's incredibly sad. It's kind of a sign of the times. We kind of touched on it there earlier about it's never been busier, or there's more news but less revenue. How does that work for you guys? Like, how does that work in the media industry? Because I think a lot of people won't understand. I think people will be thinking, sure, it's great, I'm on the website every day, or I'm buying the paper every day.
Yeah, I mean, so the sort of traditional business model has always been that advertising revenue will make up for the costs of producing journalism, which is obviously incredibly expensive. You know, people mightn't always appreciate that, but it's very, very pricey to put together a newspaper. So the cover price would only cover a fraction of those costs. It would be wouldn't be as big a moneymaker as ad revenue. And that's what's been seen across, I suppose, the wider media sector, a fall in advertising revenue. And particularly with digital, there was a couple of challenges that COVID presented. There was kind of there was a bit of softening in digital ad revenue anyway. Certainly, that was what was being forecast. And so, with COVID, anyone that's had any kind of marketing plans had to put those on the back burner. And of course, if you're digital, you know, you don't. Unless you have a subscription, you don't really have any other means of making revenue. And there was also, I'm not sure if this is still happening, but there was a period where ad buyers were looking to avoid having their messages appear alongside coronavirus stories. And obviously,
of course,
in a show in town, it's you know, leaves very few opportunities to place ads. Now, I don't know. To be honest, if that is still happening, but that would have certainly caused a lot of problems for newsrooms.
That's something you never even think of. Just something so obvious. But when you said it, I can now instantly think back of all those Twitter storms of, you know, holiday ad, oh, fancy a nice holiday in Greece. And above it is like, oh, COVID death spike in Greece. Yeah, you know, and it's something. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And yeah, like travel businesses, MCD or concert promoters, that kind of thing. They would obviously take out a lot of ads. So when their activities are impacted, then it can leave quite a big hole. The government has been taking out ads in newspapers. That's probably one thing. If people are buying the paper, they'll notice a lot more of those sort of public notices. And I think the various groups are lobbying to continue that, because we had a piece in last week's edition about local newspapers. And obviously for them, if they're dependent on their communities taking out advertisements, and if those communities are suffering because of COVID, then they really need some kind of intervention to try and help them see through all this.
Mm. I actually read that piece. Kind of makes, when you see it, it's just total sense. Of course, no hotels are going to be advertising, no local shops are going to be advertising, they're all closed. Yeah, it's just the knock-on effect, the trickle-down. We actually might talk about that at the end, actually, if you've got 5 minutes, we'll just... But first, we'll start with some positive good news story, the rich list.
Yeah.
Tell us how we get on the rich list, Connor.
Well, so I feel like I had to do a bit of swatting here. It's a little bit like preparing for an exam for me, because the list that was published this year was made by my colleagues in the US, or sorry, in the UK, I should say. So there is normally an Irish list, and the plan is to publish that later this year. Obviously, with coronavirus, it's kind of meant that publication has had to shift to try and match up with those new timelines.
Mm-hmm.
So how you end up on the rich list? Well, it's a compilation of this edition anyway. It's a compilation of the 1,000 wealthiest business people and families and dukes and all sorts in Britain. So there's a couple of Irish names on it, but as I say, there's usually a separate list for the Irish market this year. It's, as I say, it's just coronavirus has sort of impacted schedules. It's put together by a chap called Robert Watts, whom I've actually never met. I've only known him through the rich list. So he has the task of compiling what I can only imagine is hours and hours of work of trying to put together public documents and substantiate people's claims about their wealth as best you can,
because it's a chunky piece. Like, I mean, it's if you can see it there, like, it's, for anyone not familiar with it, like, it's, how many pages is it? It's 130 pages. Like, so it's a book in itself. Yeah. Is that his full-time job, or is he a journalist day-to-day as well?
That's a brilliant question, because I don't know the answer. As far as I know, I mean, he's the guy that compiles the rich list. So I'm not sure what else he gets up to each year. That would be quite a mammoth task in itself.
Yeah.
Anyway. As was pointed out in this year's edition, a lot of the work had been done by February, which, if you remember, was our last month of, you know, pretty much normal life. Not so much coronavirus related stuff seeping into everyday life. So he had pulled together most of the data by that point, and has obviously had to revise a lot of it to sort of match the new life that we find ourselves in. So I mean, it's as accurate a reading as you're ever going to get of people's wealth. But kind of rightly points out himself that there's a sort of asterisk beside some of this year's entries, just because depending on what your assets are tied up in, if you are exposed, you know, to a particular market that's going to be suffering a lot from coronavirus, then it's anyone's guess what impact it will have on your wealth.
Yeah, it must have been an absolute nightmare, because I didn't even think of it. I sat down to read it this morning, and then I was like, yeah, he's had to not completely redo. It's impossible to completely redo. But like, even just trying to get an approximation of how things have fallen. There was one guy he mentioned, Philip Meeson. He was Jet2 Holidays, and he was worth, I think, 1.4 billion. And he's down to 300 million now in, 2 months?
Yeah. There's been a lot of that, I'm sure, with people that have risen over the last couple of years and have unfortunately fallen in the last couple of weeks. Like anyone that's sort of travel related, it's kind of like at the moment, it's something I'm looking at for a piece that we're planning to do, just looking at the travel sector. It was one of the first to suffer from the consequences of COVID and the lockdowns, and it's likely to feel the effects of it for such a long time. You know, people, it's so dependent on how countries deal with quarantine, with people moving in and out of their borders, with just capacity of airlines. Like, that's what we hear a lot about now in the business pages, is the effect it has on the aviation sector, because they're dealing with lots of different problems, and surprisingly, it's an industry that's hard to make a lot of money in. It's very expensive. We often overlook the likes of Ryanair, which has had its results this week, they've got quite a bit of cash in the business that's going to hopefully help see them through this challenge. But certainly, no easy task to deal with. Coronavirus.
Yeah, I think people overlook that, just kind of probably because they're so close to home. I think people overlook how unbelievably successful they have in an industry, as you say, that's notoriously tough. Like, most of them are like a whisker away from going bankrupt at any stage. It's like some of them went bankrupt in the first couple of days. I remember reading back, I can't remember who it was now, but a couple went straight off and were like, yeah, we're gone. I know friends of mine that their family were in Spain. And there were talks again and left there because the airline was just about to pull the plug on it. I think we over kind of look how well they've done. And so top of the list this year was James Dyson.
Yes.
The Dyson Corporation. So he jumped up to the top this year. He's up 3.6 billion to 16.2 billion. And it was a weird article, actually. It was the title, he's number one, obviously. And the title is, I blew £500,000 on a car. I was talking about, half a billion quid in a car. And it was how he talked about how he tried to make a rival to Tesla and has just scrapped it before he even launched it.
Yeah, it's quite an interesting interview, all right. Particularly because I don't think that was very well known.
The last I heard, he was flying at it. He was going to break all sorts of records and was going to be, you know, sustainable and, you know, going to take on Tesla. So I thought it was a really strange, like an anti-interview. It was strange. What would the thinking be behind that, or would that be something he would have put out there, or to kind of negate the fact that he's top, or what would that be?
Well, it's hard to know. I mean, it's kind of, I don't know what the circumstances of agreeing to the interview was, or anything like that. But I would imagine, like, when you read his story, and particularly when you read the list in the context of coronavirus, like there's a sort of focus on entrepreneurial spirit, and that's highlighted in sort of in any bits of analysis within the list, that kind of entrepreneurial fire and trying to, you know, invent ways out of problems is seen as crucial to helping get through the current situation. So I'd imagine it was probably very much shaped by that. He's talking about a failure that he had in his lengthy career, but it sort of highlights the fact that that sort of thinking, that sort of gusto and desire to try and improve things is what should help us get through coronavirus.
It must be incredibly hard to get an accurate figure of someone's wealth. How would they even start to calculate that?
So a lot of the information comes from public documents. And one thing that's always a big feature of the list is there's plenty of names that you've probably never heard of, or you've heard very little about, these kind of low profile billionaires and millionaires. I think, you know, sometimes people are unaware of how much information is in the public domain, possibly because, you know, not as many people know where to look for that information. But most of it would come from public documents. I do know that people try to present information themselves, which has to be substantiated. But there are some people listed there that they're willing to share information about their wealth. And the reason being is because they don't do media. They're probably, you know, they've avoided it for whatever reason. So they keep a low profile, but they know that this document comes out every week, every year, this publication. And they want to make sure that the information in it is accurate. So it's a combination of piling together public documents that are hidden in the company's house, in the UK's case, and shareholder documents as well. And then also just corroborating people's stories, because obviously there's people that would like to exaggerate their wealth. So
Kanye. So it was Forbes he wrote to. He wanted to be on the rich list. He started giving them a list of everything he owned and everything he was. Was it Kanye? I think it was Kanye, wasn't it? A few weeks ago.
Probably.
That's a safe bet. We'll go with Kanye. He wrote to, I think, Forbes to tell them all the wealth he had, that he was a billionaire and this is how much he had and where he had it. And he broke it down for them, even into, I'll check it as we're chatting, but he broke down, I think, even into the amount of cash he had on hand and things like that. And when you say public documents, what do you mean in terms of, you know, are the company filings or returns or what is it?
Company filings, that would be kind of the main source of any kind of information on company's activity. And you can also see people's shareholding as well. So you can kind of do a bit of basic maths to try and make the assessment. Also, there's plenty of people listed in the rich list that would own shares in publicly listed companies, which obviously, as a legal requirement, have to disclose information. So you can kind of work out from there as well what their wealth may be, and also how much exposed they are to things like coronavirus. That's probably what, you know, the last couple of weeks that would have been the big scramble would have been to try and figure out if someone is very much tied into the public markets, what that havoc created on their personal wealth.
That must be an absolutely monstrous task, though, considering most of these people have interests all across the world and you know, have various entities and various kind of, you know, offshore, you know, they might live maybe in Monaco or Monte Carlo. Does that add to the complexity of it?
Yeah, I mean, it's not, I think, so Robert Watts, the chap that puts together a list every year, he actually wrote a piece about this for the Times, and he was saying, you know, it sounds great if he's the guy that's compiling the rich list. You might conjure up images of him heading off to the Bahamas, to do a bit of investigative work. I'd imagine sometimes, you know, particularly with people that like to keep a low profile, they can have quite complicated setups for their companies, because for whatever reason, maybe there's a strategic reason for doing that, but you'd also imagine there's a certain number that want to keep as much information from the public domain as they can. Watts is just a wizard at finding this information and compiling it together for the list. There's also a team of editors that would work on the publication each year as well. So there's a bit of assistance there. It's not just one man having to put everything together himself.
Yeah, even just to think of it, I put up that I was chatting to you and a friend of mine texted me. He's like, do people ever want to stay off it? Do people actively try to stay off it?
I don't know, just given that I'm not involved in the production of it, but it wouldn't surprise me if people would prefer to be off it. But as I said, like, there are some, particularly those low profile people, they know that it's going to be published each year. They've appeared on it for however long. As far as I know, most of the interaction is with trying to make it more accurate or to disclose information that might be more difficult to obtain. But I'm sure there's plenty of people that would rather keep things quiet.
Definitely in Ireland anyway. What kind of stood out to you from this year's list? I know Corona is the thing. It probably was a nightmare timing for them to try to put it out. What kind of else stood out for you on this year's list?
I was swatting through it myself. Luckily, because I wasn't involved in production, I can kind of look at it from more of a reader's perspective as opposed to reporter. But I think some of the highlights, like you mentioned the James Dyson interview, there's a couple of interviews there. And again, I think it might be a sort of sign of the times. There was one interview with a woman called Kelly Choi, who runs a chain called Sushi Daily, which, to be honest, I wasn't aware of. There's quite a few business people there, just given that it's a UK market, which wouldn't be my beat, that I wouldn't be familiar with. So I was kind of struck by her story, probably because it was, so it's basically like a chain of these sushi kiosks that they're sort of set up in supermarkets. And the idea was to sort of educate European palate to sushi, to real sushi.
Okay.
And it sort of fit in with supermarket strategy of trying to be a bit more, seen as more front runners of, you know, new foods and trends and things like that. There's certainly a move towards that. COVID has definitely put the brakes on this kind of activity. But there was a move towards trying to find niches or, you know, looking at more innovative foods, and people were moving away from,
Dunnes were pushing that hard before. They had the coffee shop, and I think it was out in Blanchardstown there recently, and they had their Dunnes was completely redone, like the inside coffee shop, and to like all these different kind of areas. You wouldn't even really feel like you're in a Dunnes. It was more like a food market. It was really, really cool.
Yeah, there was a shift towards the last, certainly in the last couple of years, and you know, a few Irish smaller brands. Well, actually, they're much bigger now, but if you think of the likes of Strong Roots, they've kind of benefited from this shift towards trying to find newer, more exciting products. Kelly Choi from Sushi Daily, like, her story is, which you can read in the Rich List. She set up a communications business that had to be packed in, and was very, I mean, she's quite forthcoming in the interview. She basically was depressed because of the situation she found herself in. And through all of that, Kate had this sort of light bulb moment where she decided to focus on what gave comfort to her, which was her mother's cooking. And over time, that translated into a business, which by all accounts is very successful. I'd imagine COVID has sort of, you know, surely has had some impact on that, just given that the way people behave in supermarkets is very different now. Mm. But by all accounts, was quite a successful strategy before that. So she's sort of, her story is sort of, you know, I failed at my previous business, but from that came this shining light, which, you know, that's the sort of, I think that seems to be what's standing out a lot from the rich list, because obviously some people were particularly impressed with its publication during COVID-19, just they kind of thought, you know, that in some way, at a time when people were unsure about their future, either for health reasons or for financial reasons, that it was seen as maybe not the best timing to publish a list of 1,000 wealthiest people in Britain. But I think when you read the analysis of it, it's very clear that that, you know, there's warrant in doing it at this time, because it shines a light on the fact that entrepreneurs will be important with the economic recovery. But it also points out, you know, there's the 0.01% of the wealthiest people, some of them were in the UK, were trying to avail of government bailouts. And I think having information on their personal wealth can sometimes put into context, you know, their behavior with dealing with coronavirus. And and as I say, in the UK, there's this kind of move from some businesses to try and seek government bailout.
Yeah, poor old Richard Branson. He can't do right for doing wrong. He gets hammered on all sides, and no matter what he's doing, I suppose. Look, it's the double-edged sword, isn't it? Of building your brand on yourself, and then when the downturn comes. But I can understand why people were. But I think it's a snapshot of where the world is at a year. I always love it because I feel it's always kind of a photograph of where we are in history in terms of business and where we are, especially about trends and stuff that's happening, because, you know, things move so quickly now. You know, like people, like literally the guy we were talking about there, you know, down 700 million in weeks. And it brings me kind of on something that you talked about there over our email, was paper fortune versus, you know, healthy balance sheets versus, you know, debt fueled businesses. And that's been a focus recently about, you know, businesses fueled largely on venture capital and debt. So what kind of stuff did you see in this year's sheet that kind of surprised you?
Well, I mean, it's probably not that surprising given what we've been hearing over the last couple of weeks. But as I was saying, you know, anyone who is very exposed in a given sector, like travel is just such a minefield at the minute, or anyone who's heavily exposed to the sort of whims of the stock market, you know, in a scenario like this, it really exposes depending on your business. But if you're very much exposed to those kind of whims, then something like coronavirus is obviously going to wipe a significant amount of your, as you say, your paper wealth. I think it for me, it sort of highlighted again, it comes back to those low profile people that tend to dominate the rich list each year. Anyone who's sort of, you know, maintained their business over the years, that have plenty of cash to hand, that maybe haven't, you know, as you say, they haven't chased certain they haven't chased the venture capital route, and they haven't maybe taken as much out of the business for themselves as well. It seems like they're going to be the ones that fare best in this situation.
Yeah, there's been a huge, it's been well publicized, all the large tech firms that are leveraged up to the hilt. And you were saying, you know, it's kind of like old money, new money. I suppose an Irish term would be kind of the old money. I was reading about this guy, the Duke of Westminster, and I had to read this like two or three times. And it was, is 10.29 billion is his, he's 29 as well, just to make us all feel a bit better. And they've had, I think it was something like 3,000 acres, I think is what their ownership is. It's a bonkers story. But as you say, yeah, old, you know, where there's this kind of land and wealth. And one, I saw there was analysis done today of US versus UK. Someone pulled the top 10 from the US versus the UK, and mainly the US is heavily tech-based. So the Bezos and the Zuckerbergs of the world versus the UK is mainly traditional, kind of like Dyson and people who have land.
Yeah, and I think I it's probably that that Duke. Sorry, there's a couple of Dukes on the list.
There's a lot of them.
None of whom I'm that familiar with, or familiar with at all. But yeah, you'd imagine, you know, their money is tied up with, or their wealth, I should say, is tied up with, you know, vast amounts of land that have that they've inherited, that have probably been in their family for God knows how many years. It's unlikely that they're going to feel much impact from COVID-19. I think as well, there's a few other takeaways. Like, obviously, anyone that is, like when you're touching on technology, there was kind of a brief analysis on the gaming sector, which, I mean, within Ireland, there's certainly a number of, you know, gaming development companies, and we've got Keyword Studios, which have their headquarters in Ireland. They're listed in the UK, but they have their base in Ireland. And it kind of highlighted, I suppose, some of the other issues with COVID-19. So not necessarily looking at personal wealth, but how easily they can transition to whatever the new normal is going to be. Just kind of this sort of snappy analysis of gaming, and the fact is they've always worked in small teams, and they have, you know, there's a large number of their workforce would be working remotely regardless of whether there's a pandemic or not. So yeah, this kind of it sort of highlights a couple of industries that, you know, you'd imagine will fare better than others.
What are you seeing in the last kind of couple of weeks? We're kind of getting deep into COVID now. What are you seeing emerge, you know, trends like that you're talking about, you know, gaming is suddenly starting to rise up. What other kind of stuff is bubbling up that you're like, oh, that's kind of interesting?
So, I mean, like any sort of crystal ball gazing at the moment, it has that caveat of we don't really know what's going to happen.
You've carte blanche here. Go for it. Go as wild as you want.
Yeah, but I think like you can see other change, like things that have been accelerated because of COVID-19. So things like how quickly the banks were able to make those changes to contactless payments, you know, increasing the threshold from 30 euros to 50. That was born out of, you know, a need to try and reduce the amount of physical contact people had with making transactions. I think, like, you can see a certain acceleration of what may have been happening over the last number of years. Suddenly now there's you know, a very strong incentive to push ahead with some of those changes. So we are, you know, for the last 5 years, people have been talking about the demise of cash, and it being replaced by digital transactions. That's obviously going to increase a lot for two, I suppose the two main reasons is it's out of necessity for social distancing, but also people that would have maybe been a bit fearful of using certain technologies, they've been exposed to them now and have probably realized actually it's not as bad as I thought it was.
And be afraid of.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, the same would apply for, obviously, just, you know, one of the big stories of the last couple of weeks was the massive transition from bricks and mortar retail to digital retail. I would imagine there's a percentage there. I'm not sure how many exactly, but there would be a percentage of people there that would have probably otherwise never or been much more reluctant to use those kind of services. They've now sort of jumped on the bandwagon. They've made the plunge. It's unlikely they're ever going to go back. So yeah, you can kind of see, I mean, those would be the more positive changes, I would think anyway. They're certainly, they give, there's a bit more activity from smaller businesses, particularly on the retail front. They may have, like when we're talking about e-commerce, they might have been a bit more reluctant to embrace it or may have found it more difficult or for some reason had been put off by it. This has kind of given them an incentive to try and chase it. But I mean, like I've talked a bit about the tourism sector, it's something I would cover quite a bit in my reporting, and it for me is just the big unknown. I really don't know how it's going to recover from it. I'm sure it will. It's just, it's more like at this time, when you're so dependent on international visitors and nobody can come to the country, I think it's something like 75% of the overall sector would be pretty much dependent on international trade. How that's going to look in a socially distanced world is just very hard to imagine.
Yeah, it is. I would have worked a lot in tourism and hospitality as well. And from March, I must pull the figures, but I would use an educated guess of 90 to 95% of our entire customer base was American. Mm. So that's gone, and that's gone for at least the rest of this year, at least. Mm. I would imagine it's gone until next spring. So that's a year of revenue gone for most businesses. And they would travel, they'd come into Dublin and they'd do kind of the loop, as I think of it. They'd do, you know, Cork, Kerry, Galway, Dublin. And so that's a lot of revenue in each area going and now gone. And when they come back, the cost is going to be astronomical for them to get back, because a lot of the airlines will be gone. So they'll be paying more to get here. And, you know, it's hard to go down the value chain of all the knock-on effects of, okay, there's all the hotels now that one of their guests, there's all the tourism providers, the guides, the activities. You know, it's a very, very exposed sector. It's something I think we're only going to start to see, especially the time, you know, we're coming into tourist season now, and, you know, there'll be probably a wee bit of bounce back towards, you know, August, September, if social distancing kind of works and there's no second wave and people can kind of move around the country. I think domestic tourism will get a bit of a bump, you know, the Dingles of the world. But I think, yeah, cities will struggle.
Yeah. I mean, I'm even thinking, like, if you're a holiday maker, there's no protocol. That's probably the big thing. We don't really know. We can't really envision what it'll be like to have to check in at a hotel, you know, at 2 meters distance from everybody else, just to use an example. But I can't imagine what it'll be like what the incentive would be like. There's kind of, as you point out, the expectation of a domestic bump, and that's sort of born out of people's boredom at home.
Yeah, frustration.
Yeah, and they have probably have a better idea. Like if you've been adjusting to life in lockdown at this stage, and you've been lucky to keep your job, and you have a better idea of your disposable income, you might be able to think a bit more about, well, you know, when things ease off over the next couple of months, perhaps it might take a weekend away. But it's hard to imagine that will make up for, like, as you point out, with your own business, the fact that so many US visitors, like, obviously there's not the market within Ireland to fill that gap. So I'm sure, I mean, we're obviously at government formation stage, so we'll have to see what the next program for government is.
You do it. You take it for this 6 months. Pass the parcel, whoever's left it against me, Taoiseach, for the next 6 months. There was one name you mentioned, actually. I'm a big fan of his. I actually want to chat to him before we kind of move off. And we might actually chat a little bit about, you know, how you work with startups and you know, how startups can get kind of, you know, get themselves into kind of press coverage and things like that. But Ben Francis, the founder of Gymshark.
Yes. Yeah. He's kind of the star of the, there's like a section within the rich list of the, you know, the younger entrants.
I must actually pull him up there as you're talking.
Yeah. He's 27 and, he's built up Gymshark, which I know you're a fan of. It's an athleisure brand. And it seems like as well, I mean, his empire, for want of a better word, is, I suppose you can classify it as an empire. It's sort of direct to consumer stuff, and he's been successful at using influencers to try and push the brand out there. So you'd imagine, I mean, again, everything is just a question mark over people's appetite for spending, but you know, I think given that he's not, you know, he doesn't need his brand in in massive sporting retailers that he would he'd be able to manage any kind of difficulties with coronavirus a bit more easily than someone who's dependent on the Mike Ashleys of this world to get their product out there.
Mike Ashley, another one who covered himself in glory. Yeah, you've kind of nailed it there. So he 2012 he launched, and he's now worth 138 million conservatively. He's 27. He's an absolute fascinating character. He's got a YouTube channel. It's worth watching. He's possibly the most normal 27-year-old. So quiet, so unassuming. I think I'd be unbearable if I had that much money at 27. You wouldn't be able to talk to me. But I suppose that's what makes him brilliant. Like it's a fascinating story. Yeah, I would recommend anyone that's listening to go and have a look at him, because their growth has been explosive. And I think you've just nailed it there. They could potentially become a massive beneficiary of this, because they were never bricks and mortar to begin with. So they have evolved from 2012 with just this new model of never been in a bricks and mortar store. They used to do pop-up stores and events and these drops whereby they'd come to a city and just create this whole little village for a couple of days, and people would queue for hours to go in and buy the stuff. It's marketing at its very, very, very best. Like I think you've said it there in terms of there's people who will, you know, who have evolved a new way of working even before this, like the gaming studios who are just where they probably saw things coming. They're like, he's 27, so he's of a different vintage of people who would have been, I want to start a business, I want to start a shop, I'm going to start a factory. You know, these are people who always were digital first.
Yeah, and it's interesting because he's talking about, in the interview he did with the Sunday Times, he makes it very clear that he expects Gymshark to become a sort of Nike, as in, you know, very synonymous with not quite sports, because I don't know if you wear athleisure clothes and you're actually in the gym. I'm not entirely sure about that. It's more the lifestyle that you're from. But his ambition is quite high. But any of those brands, I mean, why do we pay so much for them? It's because they represent something, particularly for, you know, if people are particularly aspirational and they feel that the value added by these brands is that kind of lifestyle that they promote. And I think that's probably why he's been successful. He's as you point out, he's pretty savvy with YouTube. I think as well, it's mentioned in the interview, his girlfriend is similarly, you know, they seem to be something of a power couple.
She is. She has 400,000 subscribers on YouTube, so I'd say she's doing quite well herself. I'd say she's not too worried about what he's up to. But like, it's interesting. But even like the lads at Gym and Coffee here, the lads are flying. Niall and the lads are absolutely flying, because you know they saw what was coming as well, and they've combined that kind of lifestyle with what you're doing. I was at their third birthday celebrations there, and they climbed the Sugarloaf, and I'd say there was 500 or 600 people there, you know. And it's just building that brand around. Again, the lads started direct to consumer, and they had pop-up shops and stuff. Niall did a great video, I think it was yesterday, the day before, just explaining how they've been affected. It was very honest and very kind of revealing, and I think that's kind of why the lads are doing so well, that they've kind of, they understand what it's like, you know?
Yeah, and I know they've also, like, there is some similarities, certainly, you know, the fact that it's a new, well, relatively new brand, as in, it's, you know, hasn't been around for as long as Adidas or whatever. But they've still managed to create some kind of value, because they've presented that story that people have been intrigued by. But also they've kind of legitimized that story with the events. And I know they're pretty much involved. They're pretty well involved in any kind of wellness.
Yes, anything. Yeah, and they become synonymous with that. You know, if you see an event in Ireland with wellness, they start off just organising loads and loads of free events, and it's genius, really. It's superb marketing, you know, and it's kind of the new wave of marketing. Before we kind of wrap up on this, what, you know, you've extensive experience of dealing with, you know, entrepreneurs and startups and kind of new businesses. And a lot of people listen to this are either aspiring entrepreneurs or early stage entrepreneurs or even established entrepreneurs. So what kind of advice, I think, would you kind of give them in terms of, you know, building some sort of presence within the media, you know, even dealing with the media or preparing their brand to be in the media? That's a lot of questions there. Sorry, that's one of those triple, horrible, horrible triple questions. Take it whatever way you want.
Okay, that gives me three
options to go with.
I think there's a couple of things that sort of come to mind when you asked that. I think, first of all, maybe understanding the media is probably a good place to start, because then you have a better idea of, well, if you're trying to pitch a story, first of all, you should have a better idea then of where to pitch it and to who, but also to maybe have the expectation, you might have a better expectation of what a reporter would be looking for. Mm. So for myself, with the Sunday Times, we cover startups, maybe not as often as we should or as we'd like, but any story that we will tell of a startup, I think there's a couple of options, say. So in terms of news stories, if you have an understanding of what's newsworthy, then you'll understand why someone will choose to cover your story, or maybe why they won't. Because very often you'll get pitched stories that aren't newsworthy. So, for example, if someone sends a cold email and it's not very clear, you know, why they're contacting you, they're sort of just looking for any kind of coverage. Mm. Then it's much more difficult to make an assessment of where they might fit. So I think if you're going to be approaching reporters, maybe the first thing to realize is what they're expecting from a story. So for myself, news stories are pretty clear cut. Anyone who reads the Sunday Times business section will know, you know, we've populated with pretty snappy news stories, and those are usually, you know, company A buys company B, or if a tech company has won a significant contract with, you know, a big group or a recognizable name, then that would make for a good fit. But in terms of the more maybe nuanced stuff, so for example, we have a big feature every week. And then also, you know, a couple of mini features that are dotted throughout the paper. Startups would often appear in those sections. I think what makes for a good pitch is if you can give a narrative of where your company fits into maybe a bigger issue. That's usually much more helpful when you can kind of visualize where someone might fit if you're going to be writing a lengthier feature. Probably the best advice, but I'm sort of rambling here because I'm trying to think, I think that if you engage with a PR company, if you can afford it, that's obviously the big problem, is a lot of people can't, but they would at least be able to help you hone your narrative or have a better understanding of how you might be able to pitch your story. It's not easy to get coverage as a startup founder, probably because, as everyone knows, there's lots of startups that just don't make it for whatever reason, and business reporters would be maybe a bit more reluctant to cover them, just because, you know, in the grand scheme of things, they're on a much smaller scale, they're less newsworthy because, you know, they're at the very beginnings of their journey. But I think if you can find a way of fitting what you're doing into a wider narrative, so for example, with COVID-19, I'd imagine there's plenty of startups and businesses that have either, you know, what they're doing has suddenly become incredibly much more important, or they've had to rejig their business and they're probably a bit more agile because they're so new and have suddenly come across a winning idea, then if you can get that across in your pitch, then it makes it much easier then to sort of, you know, engage with someone and realize that, okay, they're worthy of talking to.
I think that's,
hopefully that helps.
No, that's brilliant advice. And the COVID thing is a perfect example for people to think of. There's been so many stories, and journalists have been so good recently about profiling young Irish startups who are doing something kind of interesting, who've just taken an idea, tweaked it a little bit, you know, the plexi screens or the work from home desks. There's been tons, and or, you know, Irish food suppliers or whoever it is, there's been tons and tons and tons, which on a normal day, you know, company A launches a new desk. That's not really going to get you in the Sunday Times. But because of the larger context, and they've known that, okay, you know, they're going to be writing about COVID anyway. This is where I fit into this. I think that's important, because I think a lot of people think, oh, it should be interesting, or, you know, I should probably get in the paper, or, you know, think it's more interesting than it is. So I think that's super advice there. Like, know who you're talking to as well. Definitely know who you are, what you cover. Read the paper. It's a good advice. You see, I've a few people pitched to come on the podcast. This is a much smaller scale, but like, it's like their first day, and you're like, all right, cool. Maybe in a few months we'll have a chat. And I'm sure you get that all the time. Oh, we just start set up, and they're full of enthusiasm about, you know, we're going to do this and going to do that. And it's kind of like the old quote: you can't build a reputation on what you're going to do. You know, you don't want to put your name against the lads are going to do this, and then 6 months time they've kind of fallen out of love with it and they've gone on to something else.
Yeah, like, I think if you're at that stage, so if you're a young company you're trying to get some kind of coverage, the best thing to do is to have some kind of external validation, whether that's, you know, if you've been backed by someone who's quite significant in your given sector, that's a great validation, because it's, you know, if this person is backing this company, then maybe they're worth speaking with. Sometimes awards can also lend themselves to that as well. But as I say, if there's any kind of external validation, whatever it is, then that usually makes it a bit easier to make that assessment, because you get pitched stuff all the time. And the other thing to bear in mind as well is, if particularly if you're going to a reporter like myself, I have to get it through the
kind of you put your name on and go, look at this.
yeah. So like when I'm trying to find the narrative myself, or trying to legitimize a story or say why we should be covering this company or that buyout or whatever it is, then it's much more helpful if I'm aware of that kind of stuff and I can make a better decision.
I was chatting to Mark Little on the pod about two or three months ago now, and he described it as that moment where you're like, that's interesting. That's so if you're having a pint with someone, you're like, oh, that's really interesting. As you say, that's a great one, is if there's someone kind of, you know, of note behind them, or someone of a higher reputation, or, you know, someone famous or whatever it is. You see with the rugby lads quite a bit. CJ Stander launched his new product in Aldi this week. That was in the paper, you know, because that's who they are, you know?
Yeah, like it sounds probably a bit frivolous to be, you know, only if celebrities are involved. It's not necessarily that, but I think it's just having that expectation of what is news will justify some of that. Like you pointed out, company that launches a new product, that happens every day, so it's not particularly newsworthy unless it's something extraordinary and that it's already been, you know, proven to be some kind of game changer, then that's much more interesting. Because, yeah, like, even with, I know we were talking about the rich list and the fact that there's so many people with low profiles on it, and most of them have decided to do that for whatever reason, it doesn't mean that just because somebody has some kind of celebrity status connected to what they're doing, it doesn't mean that that's a necessity. You can have people that are doing stuff on a much smaller scale, but just given what they're doing or what impact it's having, that could be enough to create a very interesting story.
Perfect. Listen, Connor, thank you so much. Where can people kind of connect with you on social or anything like that? Is there any places you're kind of active?
I'm active is probably not the best word. I'm present on Twitter.
Okay.
It's just at Connor McMahon. I probably do a bit more liking and reading things than I do actual tweeting, but I'm happy for people to connect me there. And then obviously if anyone's inclined to take out a subscription to the Sunday Times, you can get plenty of good stories if you go to thetimes.ie.
Read them every Sunday. Thank you so much, Connor. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Hope you enjoyed the chat with Connor. I really geeked out on all that stuff, so I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. I'll be back next Thursday at 6 a.m. Next week, I'm chatting to Alan Coleman, and we'll also be launching the Entrepreneur Experiment Book Club. So stay tuned, and I will chat to you then.